Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, as the United Nations considers a resolution condemning the decades-long US trade embargo on Cuba, we ask, given the noises from Washington in recent years, if there's any light at the end of the tunnel for those who want to see the blockade lifted.
As the West African nation of Gambia announces that it intends to withdraw from the International Criminal Court just days after a similar announcement from the government of South Africa, we're asking if this could spark a mass exodus from the court by African nations.
International aid group Médecins Sans Frontières has announced that it is closing its final Ebola project in West Africa, as the devastating disease seems to now be largely under control. We will be asking what lessons have been learned by the international community.
Chinese government planning documents suggest the nation could be implementing a social credit scoring system. This would see citizens scored on social and economic issues, including things such as skipping red lights or not caring for a parent properly.
And could there be a pirate takeover in the North Atlantic in the coming days?
All that and more over the next half hour on this Wednesday edition of World in Focus. The United States is expected to abstain today in response to a resolution which is being brought forward right now to the United Nations by, amongst others, Bolivia and Cuba, calling for an end to the long-running US embargo against the Caribbean island.
The US has consistently voted against such resolutions, which have become commonplace over the past 20 years or so, so this could, in effect, place the White House at odds with the Republican-dominated Congress, which is fully supportive of the embargo with Cuba, which has been in place ever since the 1960s.
I want to say a few words to the captive people of Cuba. Now your leaders are no longer Cuban leaders, inspired by Cuban ideals. They are puppets and agents of an international conspiracy, which has turned Cuba against your friends and neighbors in the Americas, and turned it into the first Latin American country to become a target for nuclear war, the first Latin American country to have these weapons on its soil. These new weapons are not in your interest. They contribute nothing to your peace and well-being. They can only undermine it.
Former U.S. President John F. Kennedy speaking there in 1962 at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it was in that environment of Cold War tension between the States and the Soviet Union that he announced a widening of the economic embargo against Cuba. The embargo was, of course, first imposed 2 years earlier under President Eisenhower in the wake of Cuba's decision to nationalize its oil refineries. That nationalization of Cuban resources was in itself widely billed as a reaction to the US's cutting off of sugar imports.
But the roots of the US-Cuban embargo in reality stem from the Cuban Revolution of the 1950s, which successfully overthrew the brutal Batista dictatorship, which was supported by the USA. To date, the embargo remains in place, despite annual resolutions from the United Nations since 1992, condemning the embargo and declaring it in violation of international law.
Human rights groups such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights have also criticised the ongoing embargo, which can see anyone in breach of it potentially imprisoned for up to 10 years. In recent years, however, it looked as though there's maybe some light at the end of the tunnel for US-Cuba relations. Here's President Barack Obama speaking in 2013.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
U.S. President Barack Obama speaking in 2013. Now, despite the fanfare and a very public show of improving relations between Cuba and the U.S., in reality, not a great deal has actually changed.
Cuba is still living under a trade embargo imposed by the United States, although some small restrictions have been lifted recently, allowing tourists to bring items such as Havana rum and cigars back to the U.S. But beyond that, nothing much has changed. Today sees another call brought to the UN demanding that the US ends the blockade, this time from Cuba and Bolivia. It's unlikely to have much impact, but signals the ongoing pressure on the US regarding the Cuban embargo.
Sebastian Arcos is Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University, and he joins me on the line now from Miami. Mr. Arcos, 56 years on, is it time for the USA to accept that the embargo on Cuba has not only failed, but, well, it's actually been somewhat counterproductive in terms of relations with the country?
That is a matter of opinion. Some people believe that the policy has not worked because the Castros are still in power in Cuba. Other people assign a different policy objective to the embargo and estimate that it's a containment policy. And as a containment policy, it did not fail, and it continues to serve a purpose. So, again, it's the way you look at it. I think the absolutist way of saying it has failed because Castro is still there is kind of unfair with a policy that was not designed as a regime change policy.
The embargo was initially introduced, I think it was in response to Cuban nationalization of oil refineries, which
It's a policy of punishment for a confiscation of U.S. properties in Cuba. And
That of course, was Cuba, in response to blocking of sugar imports as well, though. So, I mean, there was obviously an argument on both sides at the time.
If you look at the timing of the escalating war between the two countries, you see that the Cubans always acted first, and the Americans always reacted to what Cuba was doing. This is clearly, when you look at the timing of the events, particularly in 1960, when you look at the comments by then ambassador to Cuba, Philip Bonsall, who was trying to mend their relationship with Fidel Castro and was continuously pushed back by Fidel Castro. Cuban and Castro always acted first, and the United States always reacted to what the Cubans were doing. This was a decision taken by the Cuban leadership to move away from an alliance with the United States.
Obviously, whether you talk to Cuba or you talk to the United States, each would accuse the other of having acted first. But now, over the years, the embargo has evolved into the most recent kind of state of it is that it's very much about human rights abuses, and that the lifting of it is dependent on the changing of human rights abuses in Cuba. Why, if that's the case, does the U.S. not apply that principle across the board? I mean, Saudi Arabia ranks very low, according to Amnesty International and so on, yet the U.S. considers it a close ally. Now, either the U.S. has some odd criteria in identifying human rights violations, or there's
absolutely
something special about Cuba.
There is definitely something special about Cuba. You are absolutely right. And if it was in my hands, the U.S. would apply the same policy to Saudi Arabia and not the other way around. I think the fact that we're doing something wrong with Saudi Arabia doesn't mean that we need to replicate the same wrong policy in the case of Cuba. And yes, Cuba is special. Again, in the context of a Cold War, when Hungary tried to break away from the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, the Soviets invade with tanks. Cuba represented for the United States the same trauma of a close ally, very close to the borders of the United States, shifting alliances in the middle of the Cold War, and the largest confiscation of U.S. policy in history. This was traumatic for the United States. It was immediately followed then by the missile crisis in 1962, adding even more shock to the trauma. So yes, Cuba is special to the United States. In many ways, it was an example of something the United States was not willing to accept in the Western Hemisphere. And in that particular context, the embargo was a success.
Now, the U.S. obviously are unlikely to lift the embargo on the basis of any calls from the UN, but President Obama has made a lot of noises in recent years about wanting to lift the embargo. Do you see that happening, especially as he approaches the end of his tenure in the White House?
No, it is not going to happen in the few weeks remaining of President Obama's presidency. It could potentially happen in a Hillary Clinton presidency, but that is not guaranteed at all. There is still a significant consensus in a Republican-controlled Congress in favor of keeping the sanctions in place. About half of the sanctions remain in place after President Obama has exercised his executive authority for the last 2 years. The more the Cubans drag their feet in moving towards a more open society, a less repressive society, and they're actually going back, if you look at what's happening in the island, the less support for the continuation of this experiment that President Obama put in place in 2014.
Well, Sebastian Arcos, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, the West African nation of Gambia has announced that it intends to withdraw from the International Criminal Court just days after a similar announcement from the government of South Africa. Matthew Aitken will be looking into the implications in just a few moments.
International aid group Médecins Sans Frontières has announced that it's closing its final Ebola project in West Africa. As the devastating disease seems to now be largely under control, what lessons have been learned by the international community?
The Canadian government has voted overwhelmingly in favour of resettling Iraqi Yazidi refugees. But why is the focus so specifically on the Yazidi community, and how far will this go towards alleviating the refugee crisis in Iraq?
And could there be, and I promise you this is a light story, a pirate takeover in the North Atlantic in the next few days?
The small West African nation of Gambia has announced its intention to depart from the International Criminal Court. There are worries that the move, which is not the first in the African continent in recent weeks, could mark the beginning of an exodus of African states from the court. Matthew Aitken has more.
The government of Gambia has announced that it will be withdrawing from the International Criminal Court, condemning the international judicial body for ignoring, quote, the war crimes of Western countries. Officials in the administration of President Yahya Jammeh said that the court has a history of only taking action against Africans, echoing a claim long held against the international body. Reuters News has quoted Gambia's information minister, Sherif Bojang, as saying that, quote, the action is warranted by the fact that the ICC, despite being called the International Criminal Court, is in fact the International Caucasian Court for the persecution and humiliation of people of colour, especially Africans. Gambia is in fact not the first, but the third country on the continent to make this decision. It comes on the heels of a similar declaration by South Africa last week, and according to reports, Kenya is also now considering the move. Well, joining me to discuss this in more detail is Professor Goran Sluiter of Amsterdam University, who specialises in international law and international criminal law. Professor Sluiter, thank you for talking to us. Okay, so this is obviously not the first time the ICC has been accused of turning the other cheek to what some people call Western crimes, by focusing almost exclusively on crimes committed by regimes in what some people call the Global South, in particular African countries. What do you say to people who make such a claim?
This claim is not convincing. I think people can look through what is and can understand what is really going on. The essential reason why African states and African leaders are now in the process of withdrawing from the International Criminal Court is that they are worried that they may end up themselves at the International Criminal Court someday. It's about protecting their own position. You cannot blame the International Criminal Court for prosecuting cases in Africa. It happens to be that, unfortunately, many Africans are victim of the most serious crimes. And also, we should not forget that the majority of these cases has been brought to the International Criminal Court by African states. So the claim now that the ICC is focusing too much on Africa is rather opportunistic.
That sort of touches on what I wanted to ask you next. Gambia's retreat from the international body makes it the third from the African continent to make this move. Burundi, of course, left in October. South Africa announced that it would be leaving earlier this month, and Kenya's parliament is allegedly mulling the move too. Could this signal an erosion of the ICC's legitimacy in any way, do you think?
Yes, well, I mean, it's a disconcerting development. I think we can all agree on that. On the other hand, the ICC has been growing until now, and we should also carefully reflect what type of court we want. If we are satisfied with a weak court in which some states that are not interested really in making an end to impunity use their power in the Assembly of States parties to actually make the functioning of the court more and more difficult, I don't think that's the situation we want. So if these states clearly are not committed to human rights, are leaving the International Criminal Court, maybe we should even be happy about this. I'd rather have a slightly smaller court, but with committed members, committed to put an end to the fight against, to put an end to impunity, than have a big but relatively weak court. So I think, although I understand the perception is bad at present, the perception is a court with significant troubles and states leaving the court, I also think we should see the positive side.
Would I be correct in saying that even if Gambia, or any other country for that matter, leaves the ICC, it's still bound by international legal norms and certain obligations?
Well, there's a lot of legal uncertainty because that's never happened, and I also would like to wait and see if all of these states you mentioned, so Kenya, South Africa, Burundi and Gambia now, are really leaving permanently. We have to wait and see a bit. The law, the statute says that then, of course, their obligations, since they at the time they were part of the statute, that these obligations would still continue. However, I think this is very much a matter for legal, for lawyers, for specialists, and quite theoretical, because once a state is out of the court, of course, that state can no longer be obliged to cooperate effectively. There's no enforcement mechanism to try to persuade that state to cooperate with the court. They have other obligations still ongoing, so they remain members to certain human rights treaties, to the Geneva Convention, which also obliges states to end impunity in case of war crimes. So there are other obligations, but they no longer then have obligations towards the ICC.
Okay, Professor Sluiter, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
It's over 2.5 years since the Ebola outbreak officially began. This week, international aid organisation Médecins Sans Frontières has announced that it will be closing its last projects in West Africa dedicated to caring for people who have survived the disease. The Ebola outbreak had a devastating impact as it swept across West Africa, infecting over 28,700 people and leading to over 11,300 deaths.
Bryce de la Vigne, operations director for Médecins Sans Frontières, has said that the suffering caused was immeasurable. He said, quote, "It had left an indelible mark on every MSF staff member who travelled to work in West Africa. For those who were infected with the disease and for their families, it was nothing short of hell. But for those recovering from the disease, the fight is far from over. The survivors suffer ongoing medical problems, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and of course, the social stigma attached to the disease."
Joining me on the line from the World Health Organization is Daniel Bosch. Daniel, as Médecins Sans Frontières withdraw from their last projects, is there perhaps space for a small amount of celebration now that the outbreak appears to be largely under control?
I think it's celebration is fine, and obviously people have come through an incredible difficult time in West Africa, but we can't just rest at only celebrating. We need to recognize that this was a signal that health systems in West Africa and many other places need to be improved, that the services that we can provide to people when they have the acute phases of illness as well as survive, those need to be improved. So sure, celebrate, but recognize that there's still a lot to be done.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine there's a lot to learn from the Ebola crisis. Perhaps there were many physical and political boundaries to treatment, but there were also many sociological and religious boundaries to treatment. What would companies like Médecins Sans Frontières, like the World Health Organization, will they be looking at all of this information and trying to analyse how best to deal with further pandemics and epidemics now?
So we all have been, as you say, trying to learn the lessons from this really terrible event in West Africa over the last 3 years. And I think there's a lot of meetings that are happening, a lot of exchange between MSF and WHO and many, many other groups that have been involved in the response. And I think we have learned some lessons. In public health, it's always hard to keep up those lessons over the long period of time, especially with some of the just more seemingly mundane but important things like funding. And so can we keep public health authorities and others responsible for funding and for priorities still interested in emerging diseases and understand that this outbreak may be over, we may have cause to celebrate, but there are still other things that are on the horizon. And we're already seeing that, right? Like Zika in the Americas and yellow fever in Central Africa. And so unfortunately, there's always something around the corner, and the message has to be basically to just try to make the long-term investments to be ready for whatever comes next.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's been enough of a joined-up approach in tackling these kinds of outbreaks when it comes to education for the people affected and treatment coming in from external forces?
I mean, enough, you know, you might say that there's never enough, and were we ready for this in order to have the ideal combined approach? Definitely not, I think, and that really goes for almost all the organizations as well as the countries themselves. So, again, a lot of hard lessons learned, a lot of tragedy in the process. I think that we have capitalized on some of those lessons and gotten better organized, but it's a difficult task. You know, one shouldn't underestimate the challenges of trying to organize, especially in these emergent settings, but that's one of the things that WHO, for example, is going through a restructuring process to be able to respond and organize better. I think almost every organization is sort of looking both externally and internally and how to have a more efficient response with the next one.
Well, Daniel, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. Thanks a lot.
The Canadian Parliament has voted overwhelmingly in favour of a plan to resettle members of Iraq's Yazidi religious minority. Members of the Canadian government voted 313-0 in favour of a bill that pledges to take in specifically Yazidi women and girls who have been displaced by the ongoing violence in Iraq. The aim is to resettle the women in Canada within the next 120 days.
The decision comes on the heels of Canadian Foreign Minister Stephanie Dion's comments that the crimes committed by Daesh against the Yazidi people in Iraq are tantamount to genocide. The United Nations also ruled in mid-June that Daesh had, quote, committed the crime of genocide against the Yazidi people. Earlier on, Matthew Ayton spoke to Idan Barir, research associate at the Forum for Regional Thinking and Tel Aviv University.
So, Reverend Shafi, thank you for agreeing to talk to us. Some people might ask, why is the Canadian government focusing on the Yazidi specifically? After all, there are millions of internally displaced people in Iraq, such as Kurds, Iraqi Arabs, and others. So why the Yazidis?
It's a good question. We've been advocating on behalf not just the Yazidis, the Christian minorities, even the Shias, the gays, the lesbians, and many of the Sabaeans and Mandaeans, which is another minority in Iraq. They are all facing great persecution. The focus on the Yazidi happened because the genocide was very clear and very severe to the Yazidi community. We are hoping that this is, can be the first step in the right direction. We're hoping that this is, we shine a light on the other minorities. And we're hoping that this is, can be the first or the beginning of admitting that this is genocide happening to also other minorities, not just the Yazidis.
Mm. And finally, if you would, why is there such an emphatic embrace for accepting refugees in the Canadian political discourse, do you think, compared to, say, at the moment in the United States and increasingly, and unfortunately, large parts of Western Europe? What is different about the Canadian rhetoric compared to those places, do you think?
I believe that we just went through an election, and it was changing from the Conservative Party, which was very active in focusing on the most vulnerable minorities, to the Liberal government, which is sadly more focusing on the refugees in general without looking at the circumstances on the ground. And my fear here, the political correctness of our government playing a role here. And now the Western world, not just in Canada, in the United States, in Europe, in England, there is a sense of political correctness. Right now, we are unable to speak the truth sometimes. But people are scared of the immigrants. I am an immigrant myself. I came to the country as a refugee after I was tortured in the Egyptian prison. So I came here as a refugee. But now the Canadian government, I think there is a failure of a quick action and reaction to the situation in the Middle East. Even though the Canadian government took 25,000 refugees came here to Canada the last 3-4 months, but they was unable to focus on the most vulnerable minorities.
Okay, Reverend Shafi, thank you very much.
Pleasure, and thank you for talking to me.
Matthew Ayton there. Apologies, I told you before the interview that he would be speaking with Idan Barir. Matthew Ayton was, of course, talking to Reverend Majid El Shafi there. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
Numerous reports this week have called into question a new social credit system proposed by the Chinese government. The scheme would create a national reputation system, reportedly assigning a social credit score to every citizen based on government-collected data on their economic and social status. The score would be based on a variety of factors. Citizens would see their score go down if they skip a red light, for example, or if they fail to look after their parents properly.
And the punishment for having a poor score? Well, you could be denied permission to travel abroad and have access to welfare benefits. It's limited. While the system isn't in place yet, it's expected that everyone in China will be enrolled in a national database by 2020. In the meantime, the Chinese government is allegedly monitoring how some companies manage their own social credit rating schemes. One such project being the Sesame Credit Scheme, which compiles information on over 400 million users by analysing their online shopping habits and consumer information.
Joining me on the line is Professor Gary King from the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. Thank you for joining us today. On the surface, this appears a little Orwellian, perhaps, or like a strange sci-fi novel. Is it as sinister as it perhaps sounds?
Well, we have to distinguish the data and the new technology from the intentions of the government. And you can interpret the Chinese government's intentions in the way that you're describing, but the technology itself isn't necessarily bad. It certainly could be used for the purposes you're describing, but it could also be used for good. And so it depends whose hands you're going to put the technology in. So you're worried about it because the Chinese government has it. If researchers had it, we could produce much good for people and for all kinds of new innovations, and perhaps people might even live longer, healthier, happier lives. So the thing that we shouldn't be upset about is the data. The thing you might be upset about is this particular government having access to that data.
What the government are planning on doing with it to, in a way, test citizens and manage their trustworthiness, is it really that different from what we have in the UK and in the USA with credit rating scores?
Well, credit rating scores in the West are limited to credit. Right, so it's pretty much just, what's the probability that if someone gives you a loan, you will actually pay it back? That's pretty much what credit scores are trying to calculate. What the Sesame Credit and these new systems are supposed to be set up to do is all kinds of other things. If you look at the apps in Chinese, they collect that kind of information about, you know, whether you paid your bills on time, and they collect, but they also collect many other types of information also. And so there's all kinds of things that you could do with this information.
But with a population as large as China's is, around 1.3 billion, is this even feasible that they can analyze this much data?
Oh, sure. That itself isn't necessarily a problem. We analyze data that's much larger than that all the time. It depends what it is you want to do with it. If they're trying to track down every individual, then, you know, that's a complicated issue. If you're trying to figure out patterns that you might not have seen before, there's all kinds of great things you could do with it. I mean, suppose we found that 20 people through the city were sick, and at all different places in the city, but they crossed paths once at a Starbucks in Midtown. And that was earlier in the day. And maybe then there's some contagious disease that we just didn't know about. So the data could be used for tremendous good. That doesn't mean that's what's going to happen, of course.
One of the ways that it's been reported that the Chinese government will be using the data is that those people who score low, get a low score, which could be that they have failed to care for their parents correctly, they could be facing a withdrawal of government support, a withdrawal of employment. Now, do these kinds of acts really encourage people to become better citizens, as the government hopes?
That's a great question. I imagine they could use it for that purpose. They said that they're not going to use it. They've said, you know, openly that they're not going to use it to figure out what your social media profile is and whether you're connected to dissidents or anything like that. But if you look at the app, they certainly are collecting that kind of information. What they do with it is a real question. Whether it's possible to use that information for all kinds of evil purposes, I think the answer is yes. But, you know, is it possible to do good with it? Yeah, that's true also.
And just finally, regardless of what the Chinese government want to do with the data, is this not opening up vast amounts of data to potentially being hacked for a variety of reasons?
Of course, once you have data, it's always possible, or at least conceivable, that someone could get it for evil intent. I just want to make sure that your listeners understand that we shouldn't stop collecting all kinds of data, because then the tremendous progress that society has made in increasing human lifespan and making things convenient and producing new jobs for people, well, that's going to go away too. The issue is, who has access to the data? That's really the issue.
Professor King, thank you for speaking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, a pirate takeover in the North Atlantic. That could be on the cards in the upcoming national elections in Iceland.
Carolyn, you're going to need to explain. Are you trying to tell me that pirates are going to take over Iceland?
Well, the Icelandic Pirate Party is currently top of the polls for the general elections by a good margin.
The Pirate Party? Is that a joke party?
Nope, they're a real party. They are likely to rock the boat quite a bit in the coming next days.
I bet their election campaign videos have a good hook, Carolyn.
Oh,
see what I did there?
Don't get me started. Sorry, Jack, I know a lot of pirate jokes, too many.
It's time for one.
Okay,
one more.
How do you make a pirate furious?
Go on, I don't know.
Take away the P.
Okay. That's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and to previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
You can also follow Sputnik News on Facebook and Twitter. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Stay tuned. The Tom Hartman Show will be with you in a few minutes. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.